glasses, so that could be. And it is that time of year, you know. It's the reason for the season.
Are we gonna fight underneath the Festivus pole?
The feats of strength.
All right. Everyone's gathered.
Everyone got their coffee. Their last coffee ever.
Yeah.
Enjoy it, motherfuckers.
I'm gonna wait up at midnight tonight if I'm even home by then. I'm gonna hold a cup of coffee in my hand so this will not be my last. I'll take one with me to the other side.
Yeah.
You're always feisty, Alan Green.
Yeah. I will not be denied coffee in the afterlife. They're gonna say, step into the light. I'm like, you guys have coffee? If not, I'm not going.
It's like that movie Being There with Peter Sellers. Being There? Isn't that what it's called? The coffee bean? Okay.
So this is all we got for the just a continuation of our coffee humor.
So, Bill, are you recording yet?
Always.
Okay.
Well, we better.
That's the mantra.
We better get this show on the road then.
Oh, it's on the road. We're just ambling. We're just strolling through the Shire.
Okay.
Has anyone seen that shit? That 48 frames per second?
Uh-uh.
The Hobbit?
No, not yet.
I have not.
Oh my god.
Pretty awesome.
It's, well, that's a conversation maybe for a later date, but. It is, it's something. It's like video, right? Like it's happening live, but yet you have to take a step back and just realize that most of the shit isn't even there. You know what I mean? Because you can't tell a difference between effect and reality. It's surreal.
Cool. Well, speaking of not being able to tell the difference between effect and reality, Justin sent me a really good article on no viable connection between Peter Lanza and U.S. Senate LIBOR hearings, even though all over the internet, in alternative media, there's like crazy amounts of articles on that supposed connection, which would be like the probability of that happening twice, even though it probably never happened at all. With you have the first the Batman shootings with James Holmes. His father worked for what company was it that he worked for? I'm trying to remember what the actual. I mean, he did. Both their parents are high ups. He worked with FICO, right? So you have FICO Yeah, so Robert Holmes, James Holmes' father, worked for FICO. And because of FICO's connection to the LIBOR scandal, which is the biggest bank fraud scandal pretty much in history, just billions of dollars, unbelievable. What is it, 16 different banks, if I'm not mistaken, something like that, were involved in this. And so, but then what's interesting is they say that I don't want to be that person that says, well, if they don't show that there's no connection, there could be still a connection. Because from my understanding, this is not a closed hearing. And it's amazing to me, after looking for like 2 hours or something for a list of people testifying, I can't seem to find anything. I just see every so often I can find a specific name. But that's the same thing that's been happening with alternative media with these guys. So even though in mainstream media you'll see a name here and there, there is no like list of people testifying, and so I find that kind of frustrating. Because yeah. I mean
the problem now with the type of media and like the media cycle is so quick, you know. Whereas a newspaper was pretty fast in that it would print new new content every day, you know? And it wasn't that people really just loved newspapers. It was just that that was the fastest source of media, you know, whereas magazines took longer, then books took a great deal longer. And now then with television and now with the internet, everything's immediate, that when something goes out into the mediascape, it suddenly can be copied a million times and tweeted, retweeted, and put on Facebook. And, you know, I posted that quote from the supposed quote from Morgan Freeman in regard to the shooting, you know, and then turns out that was fake. Or there was recently, just in the past 2 days, the video of the eagle swooping down and grabbing the kid. And that turned out that was fake as well, you know. So there's just, but then when you look up stuff.
I have a confession to make.
Yeah.
I had put an image on Facebook of Kate Middleton reading the Sync book.
Yeah.
That wasn't real.
Damn you, Alan!
I put up Mark David Chapman looking at the Sync book. That wasn't real either. I know, it was. Okay.
That guitar webs. Well,
but this. So, but joking aside, yeah, it's a really good point. Is that we're at a point where, because the speed that the information gets shared, it's no longer being. There's no way that it's being verified. There's no way that, you know, if something goes viral in, you know, 45 minutes. Mm. 37 people share an image on Facebook, or 137 or 1,000 people share, you know, you got like a, someone on Facebook, like a, I don't know, like a George Takei, you know, I always see people sharing George Takei's like comedy image or whatever.
Yeah.
So if you have some guy like that, post something that's a quote unquote quote, which actually isn't, or just one of those images with some little blurb that's saying, well, in fact, such and such happened. It's so easy for it to just get repeated and repeated and repeated, and then there's no way to really redact something like that, or to rectify it, to correct it. Because whatever you correct is going to move at the same speed.
This is like, okay, so in this article it says, in fact, research proves that Lanza has no ties to the Liber debacle, which I can consider, but then it's not, like, it doesn't show you the research.
Well, that's, you guys might have got your fill of the whole Trivium idea last week, but I think that's really where that becomes important, because that's kind of the process that's used in a court case, that's the process that's used when doing research, you know. That was something that I was taught 10 years ago at design school, because essentially you could get a design project from someone you don't know anything about, and then the first step is to do the proper background research and find the history of it, and then you remove contradictions, and then you assemble, then you start working on the actual design project, because oftentimes the instinct is to just want to start working immediately. So then when you get contradictory information, you have to have the burden of proof lies on establishing the fact, you know, because I could say, oh, I saw a UFO yesterday, and you'd be like, bullshit. And I'd be like, no, I did. And I'm like, well, I'm right. Screw you guys. But the burden of proof would actually be on me to prove somehow that I saw it. If I didn't, right. If I didn't prove it, it didn't mean that it didn't happen, you know, because that's another fallacy, is to say that because I argued something wrongly means that I'm wrong, you know, because I could say the sky is blue because it's full of blueberries, and you guys would be like, well, you're full of shit, but the sky is blue, but it has nothing to do with that, you know. So to study the logical fallacy things, that I think is really important, because then you almost immediately can see who is it that needs to prove that they were or weren't part of that scandal or not. So the burden of proof would lie on some piece of information proving that he was, or like even just one little inkling bit of credible source hinting at it, you know. Otherwise, there's nothing establishing that. And I think...
But isn't this the whole... I mean, this is sort of the biggest problem with alternative media in itself. Like, you look at the like an Alex Jones, or, you know, like one of these guys, right? They're always railing against the mainstream media. We're going to give you the news the mainstream media doesn't, you know, we're going to tell you the truth. And yet they always link back to some mainstream media article as if that's their citation. Well,
yeah.
The best thing I can give you is that I found this on a CBS website, you know, or a MSNBC or something like that. So if you're telling me that all that shit's bullshit, and then that's the best that you can come up with as a citation.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's, you know, it's in the inherent issue, yeah.
And
well, it's all about authority, isn't it? I mean, how does anyone get authority for that burden of proof? How do we listen to one person over the other? And establishing authority is the name of the game. Once you can do that, you can control something. And most alternative media, just they haven't come up with their missing link or their holy grail to provide that they have a source of authority. You know, there's nothing in the alternative. Like, there's thousands of people who will say, I've seen a UFO. There's thousands of people that will say, I've seen a reptilian. And thousands of people have cameras and recording equipment to document any kind of event. But no one has come through with a definitive object of evidence.
Yeah, and that's the thing of that, like, say, with the filming a UFO of sorts, like, it still remains unidentified, you know? Like, you might not know what it is, but there's not the connection proving what it actually is, you know?
You know what I love in this article? Sorry, but it says, the original of the unqualified information about Lanza and Libor appears to be a member of the CIA-controlled and NSA-sponsored Nameless, Faceless hacker group, Anonymous. Again, there are no citations provided to back up these allegations, but that is not the point when disinformation is being spread across the alternative media circuit. Now, when it says originator, that's like you can click on it, like it's a link, but then it's like 404 file not found. I don't know if that file ever actually existed. I mean, maybe it did, but I like how it says unqualified information about Lanza, but then it has CIA-controlled and NSA-sponsored Nameless, Faceless hacker group, Anonymous. Where's the citation to prove that?
Well, I know, and so you get into this whole rabbit hole of that you're surrounded by. Like, when you really try to research something now, on one hand, you have almost all the information on the world at your fingertips, and on the other hand, you're just surrounded by just piles and piles of misinformation. And, you know, people citing other things. Because sometimes even if you found that it cited a source, that doesn't necessarily mean that source that it cited was correct either, you know? So it does, it's not like a fast process, but to really, and that's what we just kind of want to be able to get the information quickly. Like, in contrast to even 20 or 30 years ago, if that article came out and I was going to share it with someone else on my own newspaper, I would actually have to sit down and type it out, and it would take some time, so there would be like a bit of a delay of where, and if I was actually typing something out, I'd be like, well, if I'm going to type this out myself, I probably better make sure this is legit, you know, whereas now I can just click one thing and it's immediately shared, you know. It kind of removes like the credibility of that, you know, and suddenly things can get shared at literally pretty much light speed, you know, because everyone's just one click, and sharing and sharing and sharing.
If I may, I mean, this is why I make the... I wish we could have had this conversation with Jan as civilly as this, because I'm in agreement. I mean, even like with the psychedelic experience, I see the psychedelic experience is sort of like your internet. You're getting everything at once. All your filters are dropped and you get everything at once. And people always say, that's a return to source. So it's the same idea of what is the source of the information, right?
Yeah.
So it's this idea of, like, you know, you drop everything and you get the source. But for me, what I'm always kind of trying to point out is that when you're completely bombarded with the information, when you drop all the filters, you then have to do a really long time of processing that information, processing what you receive, and then putting back some filters in to say, like, well, okay, this, does this jive, does this whatever, and then that could be where your trivium comes in, or that could be all these different steps, you know, without putting, how do I say this, without keeping an egoic armor on, stepping into the psychedelic experience and sort of missing the point there, I do think that whatever comes in needs to be really thought about and processed.
Yeah.
There's a cheesy movie that I constantly make reference to is Lawnmower Man, where there's a scene in Lawnmower Man where the guy is like, you know, goes in this virtual reality, basically like hooking up to the internet, right? And he's like just absorbing information, and he goes from being like retarded or somehow you know, mentally handicapped to, I don't remember exactly what he starts off as, but and then he ends up as this like super genius, and then like going on and on and on. And there comes a point where he's like just wants to keep tapping into this information, getting smarter and knowing more. And I think it's like Pierce Brosnan or whatever the other guy is. He's like, well, stop. He's like, you haven't even thought about what these things mean. Like, you're taking in information, but you haven't thought about it. And you need to, like, just pause and process the information.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, no, I just want to know more. And it's like, I'm looking at people in this field, whether that's alternative, you know, this doesn't have to be the more, you know, new agey or psychedelic explorers, because, you know, there's that. And then there's the people who are the hardcore alternative conspiracy researchers who are basically doing the same thing. You know, they are just taking in, okay, here's another link to a bank, here's another link to CIA, okay. And that's how I think Jan makes some fallacies of just connecting dots. It's like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, therefore you're a CIA. I mean, I'm open to that idea. Don't get me wrong. I'm very open to the idea that these connections could implicate someone. It's just not, I don't take it as a given. It needs, again, it's like you have to weigh it against all the other evidence. Not only that somebody had lunch with somebody once who also knows somebody who was also the third brother. You know, in Spaceballs, he goes, you're his brothers, aunts, uncles. He says, well, what does that make us?
Absolutely
nothing.
Which is absolutely what you nothing. Are about to become.
Well, and the problem and the reason for like total secrecy in regard to CIA and things like that is that then it makes that provable research impossible, you know? It's the same with the mafia, like guys who would never snitch on each other. They suddenly have, it's impenetrable, you know, and you can't do any credible research, and it creates its own little vacuum. It's kind of in contrast to the always record. It's the never record, you know, and so you just never, you would have a contained area that you would never know what exactly goes on in there. And I think what really, a lot more often than not in my research, that makes something really ripe for projection. The same with like Masonic stuff that, you know, that's like the uniform Illuminati, what everyone in conspiracy stuff swears the Masons are Illuminati. And because they're doing some kind of ritual and they don't know exactly what it is, they automatically assume that it's something scary. And really that comes from projection, I think, more than a credible like research thing. The same thing with the CIA, that suddenly something chaotic or something weird happened, the CIA must be responsible for that, you know. Not to say that they're not responsible for some, you know, manipulation of world events on one level or another.
Of
but,
course, yeah.
But that's where then the proof breaks down, you know. And I would add, you know, I think out of all the conspiracy people that I'm really kind of familiar with, I think Jan Ervin and then also Richard Grove like do some of the better, more credible research, conspiracy research out of everybody I know of in the like alternative research community, you know.
Sure.
And that they actually take the time, in contrast to someone like Alex Jones, who hit all there's kind of a magic to propaganda in that when something's emotionally charged, it bypasses that filter.
Yeah. Yep. Completely. I mean, that happened to me last week, because normally I would have cross-referenced this quicker, but like I quickly said I had read Caesar's Messiah when it first came out, shortly after it first came out, and I had in my mind that Joseph Atwill was actually Christian. Because yeah. I felt like I remembered him saying, despite all of this, blah, blah, blah. But then I actually looked up what it was in the book after we had a talk. And I argued with Jan about it. And then I find, here's a quote. He says, I developed these findings over the past few years, but delayed publishing them for a number of reasons. Though I am no longer a Christian, I see Christianity on the whole as valuable to society. I certainly do not wish to publish a work that might cause it substantial damage. Further, I'm aware that the nature of the discoveries might have some negative effect on some non-Christians. I do not want to contribute to the cynicism of our age. I love that. And so, like, yeah. on some level, the way that that stuck in my mind is I'm like, that dude was actually, you know, still kept his beliefs. But no, it was because he was so considerate of the of all of that, like, in the midst of all of his understanding, he didn't want to contribute to the fucking cynicism, which I completely appreciate. I thought that was awesome.
Yeah.
One specific thing that came up, you might appreciate this, Justin, was this issue with Kabbalah being mainly focused on, like, divination or ascension. His take on Da'at was that this is a secret knowledge, and in order to gain wisdom and understanding, Chokhmah and Bina, one has to first get this information. And I'm like, well, you know, who actually presents it that way? Like, traditional Kabbalah does not present Da'at that way. But what's funny is I thought about it afterwards, and I'm like, who does present it that way other than just European occultists? Because obviously you look at, like, Crowley's Path Workings or Israel Regarde's work, and you can see that this focus is almost, they're obsessed with this, like, ascending the tree like a ladder, right?
Right.
And I'm like, oh, the fucking Kabbalah Center. So, like, which sounds so official as Kabbalah Center, but Madonna's school, like Madonna, like what Madonna follows, that's completely their focus. But I can see how looking at that could give the impression that that's Kabbalah, but that's like a new agey kind of take on something. And, like, if you actually look at the Zohar, or if you look at a lot of these, you know, commentaries on the Zohar and, you know, like, older Kabbalah, it's not really like that. Like, the Da'at is, you know, our perception of reality. It's our whole thought frame. It's like, so when you look at Da'at as, like, the tree of knowledge, you know, the tree of Da'at, you know, that's the fall in the garden. People associate with sex because shortly after it says, you know, they knew each other, and then knew implies sex, but it also right. implies two polarities, you know, forming a duality in a sense, because they're, you know, that's the nature of reality, is dealing with opposites as far as our thought base is concerned. And so, anyways.
I think what's interesting in my study of this stuff, you know, when we talk about non-cited sources, I think most, or it seems like most all of the occult kind of mystical ideas are not sourced, but they have been bodies of knowledge that have been passed down for so long. And people kind of add to them and contribute to them and modify them and change them, that they then end up having some sort of weight to them or some sort of credibility. Because when you really think, like, just because it was necessarily older doesn't mean that that was, like, the better view of, that doesn't mean it was the more credible view. You know, I don't think that necessarily that the Kabbalah itself just suddenly, like, sprang onto the scene from an angel or a god or something like that, or some divine revelation. I think that when you're dealing with symbols, they almost move down through a different dimension, as far as it's like an imaginary space, you know? And that's kind of what my take on reality is, that I think there is, like, a dimension of languages and symbols and signs that we exist in this material world and in a world of language. And the whole idea of, like, the biblical stories is kind of the story of that God of language coming down onto earth, as well as, like, matter rising up to kind of then be able to receive that, you know? And it kind of, to me, that's what creates the two interlocking triangles of matter ascending up and language kind of coming down.
Sure. Well, there's this idea, too, between the difference between, like, language language and speech, right? Which is, like, philosophically, it's like the difference between, like, an opinion and a fact. Like, something, the language itself is a fact. Like, the symbols themselves are a fact. The way that they get interpreted is secondary to that, or it's different than that. I might not want to say secondary, but there are, like, these two different ways that the thing expresses itself, and both have their place, but both need to be kept in perspective, right? So whenever you're going along a chain of information, you need to be aware of where the degree is of separation between what the thing in itself is, like in its purest form. Like mathematics is like pure communication on a certain level. How you interpret what it means is totally different.
Yeah, I think you could even qualify mathematics as Kabbalah, because you're just using the numbers 1 through 10, and you're able to land the Mars rover on Mars, you know, just using the numbers 1 through 10 and some equations, you know, to represent like unknowns or things like that, and you're able to then move physical reality from Earth to a whole nother planet, you know, I think is entirely magic.
Yeah. When you look at like Ramak, who's a, you know, significant 16th century Kabbalist, all he does, like in his commentary, is just approach it from as many angles as he possibly, he's like, well, if we take it this way, then we take it this way, then we take it this way. And it's just exploring. It was just considering things like from every facet you imaginable. He sets up the parameters that is the tree, that is, you know, these spherot and this set of ideas, but then he just considers it every which way he possibly can, which is the problem that I have with a lot of the way that Kabbalah gets presented, is that it seems like just this very fixed and rigid belief structure. And it's not very liberating in that way. Whereas like when you look at the older Kabbalists, you can see that they're like their relationship to the information is very free.
And one of the many Kabbalah books I'd read, I can't remember which one it was exactly, they talk about like that really Kabbalah, I mean, it essentially just is a filing system of language, in that it has the numbers for the sephira, or you call them sphero.
Well, it depends on if it's plural or singular. If it's singular, it's sphera. If it's sephira, if it's plural, it's sphero.
Okay, so for the sphero, you just have the numbers 1 through 10, and to me, dot more than anything just represents zero. And they were trying to figure out where do you put the non-existent thing on the tree that they put to where it would. You know, in some ways, each number is everywhere on the tree. But you just have the numbers 1 through 10, and then you have the alphabet, you know, for the 22 paths. And, you know, I think that that speaks volumes, but it becomes a filing system then for everything. Like, with any system of numbers is magical to some extent, and you can then layer things on it and on it. And I think something that's valuable about it versus if you were to just do a 10-sided figure is that this shape is easier to hold in your mind because it does have some mirror to the human body. Whereas if you're trying to just imagine a 10-sided shape, it's harder to kind of hold that figure in your mind. So kind of as a meditation, this is easier to see in the kind of base, it's like a structure that's easy to, like a mnemonic device of sort.
Sure. Yeah, I mean,
you know, in all these discussions about Kabbalah, I always think of the oft-used phrase, the map is not the territory, right? Mm-hmm. And if we hold that to be true, then all maps are not the territories.
The map is the odd. So that's the way that the odd.
Okay, perfect. So, right. And it's a lie. It's a useful lie. You can do a lot of shit with that lie. You can go across an ocean and explore a new land based on that lie. But one thing that we've observed over many hundreds and thousands of years that the territory changes. It literally changes. So even if a map was deemed to be, this is the one map that is not a lie. This is it. Well, the territory changes and then makes that mat, if it ever did exist, obsolete.
Yeah.
So we're just dealing with two shifting reflections. And the fact that they bring us any kind of usefulness at all is the miracle itself.
Yeah.
And to lose sight of that is really an insult to this whole human, you know, experience. And I just can't get on board the minute anyone tries to sell you that something is the absolute truth and it's in writing, you know it's bullshit.
I agree. I'm open to anything just, until someone says, I know this is the fact as I'm presenting it, end of question. Like, no, not end of question.
Well,
I have a whole bag full of question marks that I can that I reserve the right to place all around anything you say.
Well, you should be wary of someone as like a snake oil salesman of saying that they of just taking their word for that. But there are things that are kind of verifiable truths that are important to kind of start the basic framework of understanding. You know, like even in us just having a conversation right now, we are agreeing on the function of, like, we're silently agreeing on the function of our language, of what certain terms mean, of a lot of things. You know, we're agreeing on a great deal of things. Otherwise, everyone's just going to be in their own little bubble and have their own invented language and each be. There's certainly some credibility or value to doing that, but otherwise, you know, the scientific discoveries and things like that wouldn't be possible, you know, and civilization wouldn't be possible if there wasn't that consensus agreed upon thing. The problem then lies in that what oftentimes is agreed upon as bullshit, and then that's what it becomes necessary as to have a basic filtering system of how to then determine what is real or isn't.
I think.
But see, conversations are dynamic. Mm-hmm. Conversations are the sharing of ideas and an interplay of what we agree and we move on to the next agreement. It's a dynamic process. If someone tells me that this is truth, it's a static hammer and nail. It stops the conversation. It ends it right there. There's no need to debate. This is what is. If that person can bring what they believe to be what is into the conversation and engage in this dynamic sharing of ideas, well then, I think given amount of time, anyone who's actually using their minds and their hearts together will erode whatever it is they thought to be extreme truth. Now, I think what becomes frustrating is when a conversation isn't a conversation. It becomes a battle to actually get that dynamic process going. And it's a very frustrating and exhausting experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's immediate. It becomes immediate when you begin discussing any of these things with another person, and the tone of that exchange is that bitter, that exhaustion, that just fighting for every single chance to get a word in. And I don't think that I won't judge anyone based on one conversation or one attempt to try to get a dialogue going. I think that a lot of people who are in, you know, me and Alan had this conversation about how, you know, when you used to have lodges, which, you know, Facebook groups really are just chaos lodges. But when you used to have lodges and people used to show up in person, the degrees of which the people participating in the lodge were conferred, but you basically could understand where people were at just by interacting with them because you got more information about the person.
Yeah.
And in these chaos lodges of Facebook, you really have no idea where people really are as in this sort of dynamic process of illumination. It's just a way of, and that can be a troubling idea in itself. I like the idea of Facebook not having degrees and you don't know where people are, because you have to take everything they say and actually analyze it and actually give it its time, and you actually have to process it. You won't just dismiss what someone says based on a degree or on what color robe they're wearing or whatever mark is on their forehead. You actually have to listen to everybody. And that can be trying at times. But every now and then, it's those random comments from people that, if you weren't paying attention, that completely change everything. The needle in the haystack kind of thing. And I think that, I don't know, we're in the middle of recording a grand dialogue from start to start. You know, I don't think we ever pretend that this dialogue will have a finish, but I think it will come to a new beginning at some point where it will refresh itself and maybe take a new direction. And I'm just open to having anybody become a part of it, because anyone can throw in that one sliver or shard of information that moves us, gives us the momentum to move towards that new direction. I'm not specifically speaking about anyone in particular.
Not a particular Gelfling to bring that Gelfling shard.
Well, I think there's a couple, like with the media, it does depersonalize the interaction, you know, because people will say stuff on the internet that they would never say in person, because they'd get punched in the face or something, you know, like it would cross a line that there's just like a basic civilness that then is removed, you know, and the anonymous nature of the internet oftentimes lends itself to the kind of trolling type aspect. But I think, and to bring it back to the Trivium thing once again, that you are getting information, you have to kind of do the research on the front end, which is the grammar, but also the formal study of grammar itself is important too, because sometimes if someone is misusing the structure of language, you can automatically tell where the fallacies kind of lie within that. And to remove the contradictions, but then really, in some ways, rhetoric is the most important part as far as then communicating with someone else, because as much as it's important to have factual things, you don't convince people by facts, you know. And also you don't convince people by just saying you're wrong. Like, if whatever you just told me, if I was like, no, that's bullshit, and then told you my argument, that would automatically make you resist me, you know. And like, really what can be the worst is that if you do have some valuable information that is a truth on some level or practical or valuable, but that then you can't convince anybody of it, you know, or that in the process of trying to convince or share the information, you make the other party hate you by the time you're done communicating that, you know. And that gets into some kind of questionable territory. There's the book, like the Dale Carnegie How to Win Friends and Influence People book, and that's all about how to kind of be a manager or how to convince people you're right or do things like that. And it doesn't necessarily lie. And so to me, that's just about practicing the art of rhetoric as far as, you know, when there's two different parties, how do you really get someone who's very entrenched in their own position to open up to a new idea? And it's not from a full-on frontal assault, you know, of attacking somebody. You have to be a little bit more graceful, and it's kind of an elegant, or like a, it's like an art form of sorts.
Yeah. Yeah, last week the Talmud came up. And it's one of the easiest books to pull something out of and just be like, look at what these fucking people are presenting here as what's the right way to handle something. What a lot of people don't realize with the Talmud is that the book itself is a conversation between people who are approaching something from completely different places. And it's not a laying out of laws as much as it is an argument about what different ideas about the way that things should be. And so you'll see things in there that suggest pedophilia or whatever is the right. But this is like, you know, you have arguments being made that represent such a small part of what people actually want to see occur, and much of the Talmud is just completely written off by Jews themselves and has been for you know, as long as it's been in existence. And so it can be kind of very misleading. And I find it really interesting when things get said that are so taken out of context. I don't actually care for the Talmud very much. I haven't been interested in studying it because I'm not as interested in all the different levels of Jewish culture and life, because I wasn't raised a practicing Jew, and I'm not trying to be a practicing Jew. I don't aspire towards that. But simultaneously, I don't have anything against people that do or want to recognize that side of it, which is still an important side of it. You got to realize, like, whether you're talking about Judaism or Hinduism or even just beyond like the religious text, but the text that verges more philosophically, like Patanjali for Indians, and you know, Kabbalah actually, which has religious facets, but at the same time, I wouldn't consider it an all around religious text, because these people didn't compartmentalize their philosophy as separate from their religion. But like, these things came out of cultures, like, and this is like a whole way of life that all that these philosophies are tied into. And so that's not something to just be like put down or whatever, because that's part of the thing. You know, you don't have to agree with it, but
you kind of get two issues going. One is that people want to kill the messenger, because if I said something controversial, if I said all Jews are devil and the sky is blue, you'd be like, well, this guy is full of shit. What is he talking about? And they would probably say something about the character of the speaker, but that wouldn't necessarily mean that the second part of what you said was or wasn't true, you know? But sometimes things are so inflammatory that then they automatically seem like they would disqualify the rest of what someone's saying. So that happens with the Bible. They're always talking about gay marriage and then quoting something from Leviticus of saying, oh, well, also, if that's true, then this other thing must be true, which isn't a legitimate way to actually dissect an argument, you know, because you're saying one thing doesn't mean the other thing is disqualified. And then I think with those books, like, what is oftentimes lost is that they are a collection of writings by various people, you know. It's kind of like a sync book where all the chapter headings were removed and everything scrambled together. And, you know, they might be like, well, I really didn't like that chapter that Justin Morgan wrote. But if it was obscured and scattered, then you could potentially contaminate the whole book, or it's just one person's viewpoint that then becomes associated with the entire book, you know, and you have to kind of just take it as bits and pieces and one thing at a time, you know, because there's probably very valuable information in the most controversial text ever, you know.
Totally.
I think you were right at first. I think we should have taken that Justin Morgan chapter out of the sync book.
I know.
Somebody had to say it.
So, I guess my thing here is, so like, where do we set in this one thing I want to get to is, how do we set in some subjective experience? How do we allow for that? Like, you know, like you said, your UFO experience, and you want to convince me the burden of proof is on you. If it's something you can't prove, where do we leave some room for those kind of experiences? The other thing here is that's just something that I've been kind of thinking about, is this whole trivium seems like obviously a really valuable tool. It's basically, it's a toolbox. And I wonder if every problem, can you bring the same tools to it or use them in the same order? Is this always the way to do it, or is that a dogma in itself? So that's one kind of issue I have there. And then, to me, it seemed like, you know, I really don't, it's not fair to attack Jan because he's not here to be part of that conversation, but what seemed to me a series of fallacies in themselves was, here's a person who's saying, I'm so in this sort of yogic practice of, using my trivium, it comes so second nature to me that I know. So David says a sentence and a half, and he's like, oh, I already know where you're coming from, and I got it, and I know it's bullshit because this. I use my grammar to understand that what you were saying was going to lead here. And it's like, actually, you didn't even listen to the motherfucker's sentence.
Well, you know, that's the burden of proof on their part, you know?
Well, okay, yeah, but I'm saying, like, things like, so you have, you know, these series of fallacies. Like, my thing is, like, reverting to name-calling. That's a fallacy, is it not?
Yeah.
So when, you know, there came a point, he's like, all right, Mr. Kabbalah studier. Like, that's your response? That's you know, what the fuck? That's name-calling. Well, the idea of the hypocrisy of saying his whole, you know, his thing was, I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm just anti-Zionist, elitist Judaism because it comes from this idea that they're the chosen people. And then he goes on into this whole idea of how, you know, the Huxley family had this idea of eugenics and that they were the chosen ones and they were the, you know, and anything that's a secret society or a secret anything, it's all elitist. It's as if they're the only ones who can understand. And that was his across-the-board attack. And then motherfucker ends the show by saying, you know, listen, I think this needs to be edited because, you know, we might understand what we're saying, but there's a lot of stupid people out there and they might not get it. What the fuck? What the fuck?
Yeah. I like how you open that with, I don't want to attack Jan because he's not here. And then you drop. I mean, that's,
Maybe. Hey, Alan, I just want to let you know, if there's any part of this you don't want aired, I'll send you the audio.
I mean, I think, this later. In all fairness, I do think that I don't agree with everything that Jan has presented, but I do think, because I've listened to the Gnostic Media podcast for the past 8, maybe more years or something like that. Might not have been that long, but it seems like that long. And he's done some really great research. And I think that sometimes he's just so frustrated of being entrenched in the alternative media stuff because of the massive amounts of bullshit that gets put out on a daily basis and the just all of that sometimes I think it's just more from frustration more than anything, you know? And I think that if you guys had a little more of a relaxed conversation, that you guys would have probably found a lot of common ground. And that's really where the rhetoric, the art of rhetoric, you know, there's a formal rhetoric as far as...
Okay, yeah, wait, back up. All right, so if you said that I tried to preface it by saying I didn't mean to attack him and that it came across as an attack?
No, well, I wasn't saying that.
Oh, no, I think that was what David was implying. Correct me if I'm wrong. But you know what? Then we fucking go there. So let's address that. Please address that point. I think you're right. I didn't go into that show looking to fight with Jan. I didn't go into that show with any agenda, and I still have no agenda. But I want someone to, and I couldn't get him to address the point. I want someone to address the fucking point. How do you spend 2 hours slamming elitism and, you know, if some information is okay for some people, not for others? And how the fuck do you then justify saying, you know what, but actually, I think this is some of this information we discussed today isn't fit for the stupid masses. No, I get, you know, your point of
yeah,
saying that there's a frustration of dealing with being misunderstood, or I get that. Trust me, man, all the fucking time.
Yeah.
I've only been doing these interviews, you know, for like 2 years, a year and a half, I don't know. And like all the time I'm doing a show, if I do a conspiracy show, I say something and they think that somehow is me supporting their conspiracy theory or attacking their conspiracy theory. If I do a more new agey show, then whatever information I lay out means they think it supports their thing or I'm implying something. And there's constantly that struggle to not be misinterpreted and you try and be really clear and exact, and sometimes you just get frustrated. I get all that.
Well, then,
I want someone to address the fucking point that was highly, highly hypocritical, and you know, we shouldn't use the fallacy therefore of then throwing out all his information. I just mean, that's not I don't think that's, we don't want to just toss someone's information, but they don't get to become a pope. They're not infallible either. And this to say, no, I use this system, therefore my what I'm saying is infallible. I might not be, but this system is. My system's bulletproof, so anything that comes out of my mouth has already been checked by these things. You can trust me. No, you can't right. just take the shit that comes out of someone's mouth as saying, don't worry, I already filtered it. Hey, here's a big old glass of shit. Don't worry, I filtered this for you. You know, I'm not going to drink that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And where I was kind of going with saying the frustration leads to an emotional charge that then leads the conversations to get kind of wound up. And I think in that heated moment, then it suddenly, when there wasn't necessarily aggression on anyone directly on their part, that there's like this emotional charge or like need or want to be right. And it creates like, when you re-listen to it or listen to it from the outside, you then see like a very shadow thing, you know, and oftentimes what people are attacking is a part of their own self projected onto something else.
Totally. Or something that you have a charge on ends up coming through the back door, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're all only human, you know, and I think that's maybe where the frustration comes in with someone when they're saying that, oh, well, my stuff is right and you guys don't know what I was talking about. And, you know, like I kind of wish that when I heard that he was coming on the show, I was like, oh, I would have loved to have been on the show, partially because I'm really familiar with this stuff myself, you know, and I think it would have been helpful, although it might have made his head explode at points to be like, oh, well, that fallacy is, you can't use that in a conversation like this, you know, like, because there is a lot of elitism as far as like, oh, well, I know this and you guys don't know this, so fuck off, you know, and that then puts like the burden of proof on him to qualify what he's saying rather than like, oh, well, you guys don't know about this one obscure document from something, so you're obviously fucking idiots, you know.
When I brought up Robert Anton Wilson's, you know, what I learned from him, I put under the phrase the bullshit detector, which is what the Trivium is for me. And I can respect using a more refined and more academic language to build the Trivium as, instead of calling it a bullshit detector. But for me, they're one and the same. And when I brought that up, it was dismissed as, well, you know, Robert Anton Wilson, he's associated with NAMBLA, and I'm not going to get into that. And, you know,
no, I think
it seems very hard for me to...
You'd have to qualify that, like, you know, like if you're going to say, right. I could say, well, you know, Alan is associated with NAMBLA, but I'm not going to get into that shit.
Excuse me?
No, I have documents, but I'm not going to show you guys right now, so... for another show, you know.
Right. It's too much to get into.
No, that's fucking true. We need to actually talk about that.
That's actually what the little boy told me. That's too much to get into.
He also worked at the BBC before starting the Sync Book Press, you know. And him and Jimmy Savile, they had a series of books before this, and... yeah, NAMBLA.
He was under a Swatum. he wrote a book about eugenics, I believe, under an anonymous title. There was one major thing that I really wanted to get just to put his way, and it was the one thing that I wanted to talk about. I didn't actually get to talk about because I got so immediately... wrapped up in our, you know, whatever that was. And that was that with the thing that came to me with when looking at Caesar's Messiah, when it came to me, was that this is a sync. So he's studying these two texts simultaneously. One, Josephus Flavius's War of the Jews and Antiquities of the Jews and the Gospel. And these are the only texts other than the text of a Roman botanist to have come out of lower class Judea during that time, and you know, and that place. And so I wanted to just present like how interesting that is for us that he came across what he considered a sink, and he noticed these parallels between the text and was like, huh, what happens if I explore this more? And he actually used what is probability theory and applied it to what the chances would actually be for these to correspond to the particular way that they do and the degree that they do. And what he came out with was basically as close as you can get to prove something that is still an inference, he basically did. And so that's like, that's a huge value, and I think should be very inspiring for us when dealing with synchronicity, that he is an example of somebody who found a sink and then did his best to prove it and lay this whole work out. But I can also say that looking through that book, I read it a couple times. When I read it, I had to go through it again because it just blew my mind so much, was that there's a number of things in there that I don't agree with. Not just in terms that they feel like stretches. So once but even though foundationally he established that there exists this connection to an incredible degree, he proceeds to kind of like play with it. And so he'll be like, this means this. So like they're eating a child that is named Jesus, if I recall. It was a while ago, but the Jews who are hiding are eating a child because they're starving to death. And then the Roman soldiers smell something cooking and they go down, and this woman offers the Roman soldiers half of her baby, basically. And they're disgusted or whatever. And then he says it's his whole, it's Lazarus. So she's offering them Lazarus. And then in the gospel story, they all sit down to eat and Lazarus is at the table, but he never says anything, meaning that it's a joke that they're actually like Lazarus got eaten in the gospel. That's one example, but he goes through a lot of things like that. And some of them I could dig and I could go along with. And then some of them I'm like, what? Okay. That's a stretch. Which is fine. Like, I felt like that was fun. Like, he's playing with it. But there are certain points where that wasn't really kept in perspective. Like, he didn't say, this is a possibility. He said, this is what this means. And in doing that, he kind of, I think, discredited himself a little bit. Some people would probably be turned off by the authoritative way where he says, because this is true, because there are these things that line up, then it all must be one big joke, and here's what it is.
There's certainly leaps, and I mean, you don't always want to listen to everybody, you know, like, it doesn't mean that Hitler would have been wrong about the sky being blue, but I think he was wrong about enough other stuff that I'm like, well, I probably don't really need to spend a lot of time reading his stuff, you know? That's where the filter then comes in, because oftentimes you hear stuff and that the trivium, I think, is an automatic process that kind of happens. And so then formalize it as a study that then it allows you, when you get information and you're like, huh, this seems a little fishy, that you're able to make the distinction. And oftentimes the problem lies in, like, I think the trivium is great as a form of formal as a means of formal study, but that you should then distinguish between a formal study and just strictly artistic exploration, you know? Like, and because I think even studying synchronicity is a psychedelic experience and that it is soul revealing and that you are kind of expanding out everything. Like, you don't want to put, so this is kind of the distinction I would make between the two, is that you don't want to put reins and limits and put your creative exploration inside a limiting box of sorts, unless it was being done for artistic purposes and you were only going to paint with blue for that day. You know, like that would be a good form of restriction, or to say, oh, I'm just going to write and just use words with a particular sound. That would be like a meaningful restriction to put on an artistic practice. But you wouldn't want to then say, okay, well, I'm going to like do a drawing and I want to formally figure out all this bullshit on the front end. You'd want to just kind of have an unfeathered channeling of kind of creative energy out into the world. And then, so there can be an interplay between the two of that. You just want to expand everything out, but you don't want to then say, okay, well, I did all of this channeling writing or something like that, and then say, well, that must be true, you know? And that's where a lot of the new agey stuff is obviously bullshit, is that people, they, what was true for them as far as like a creative process, and then there's like a fundamental truth to bringing creative energy from somewhere inside of you and then putting it down on paper, but they would then associate the feeling of something being, you know, like the artwork that you do, David, like I think there's a lot of truth in that, you know, just in the raw use of colors and the way you assemble and compose things, there's profound truths in that, but to have it then translate as like a formal, credible body of study, you know, then it would take some qualification, and that oftentimes that's where you can kind of get into the Terence McKenna stuff, is that he was doing these artistic explorations and then saying, oh, well, it must be true, you know, like I took mushrooms and I saw this, so, and it really seemed profound, so it must be true, let me qualify it as time wave zero, you know, which is bullshit, like, and that's kind of where you got to draw the line. And the same with Robert Anton Wilson, you can reveal profound truths through fictional writing, and a lot of his stuff was researched to some extent, as far as knowing about like the P2 Masonic scandal or different things, but you want to put a distinction on where you're taking liberties and exploring an idea versus formally presenting this as something that should be like accepted as a general historical truth or fact.
Right.
Does that kind of make sense? I didn't mean to ramble on.
No, you didn't. And we have a show that goes on for a bit usually, so it's okay to ramble. Yeah, that's perfect. And you could, the list goes on. You could say Timothy Leary. You could say, you know, you could go all over the place with people who had something very worthwhile to offer. But you cross the line when you present it no longer as a kind of like creative acknowledgement of how malleable information can be, to that this is a matter of fact. So yeah, I mean, I love a lot of people's works, but I keep them in perspective, even when sometimes they don't, you know?
Yeah. And the thing is, like, the current kind of mediascape is a psychedelic environment to some extent, you know, as much as I think on some level the 2012 time wave thing is bullshit, like, we're sitting here in completely different parts of the world talking to each other, sharing ideas. If we were fully kind of utilizing Skype, we could be sending pictures and things like that. Like, that's pretty fucking psychedelic, you know, like, we're like, no, nothing's happening, like, or we're waiting for something to potentially happen tomorrow or at any given date in the future, where we can almost see what each other's environment, you know, like that, even just 100 years ago would be considered insanely magical.
Right.
But when you're in then this environment where, whether it's on the internet and you're bombarded with all kinds of information, as far as, you know, quotes quoting other things or misquotes, or there's just such a, I think there is something to the idea of information doubling and doubling and doubling. And that's kind of, we're at this point of where information is shared with a single click at a, and so something can go from complete obscurity to front and center in the collective conscious, you know, within seconds. Whereas it would have taken 100 years, you know, for something to really catch on.
Right. So this is a thing, specifically just to bring up Atwell again, is I look at that and I have a completely different take, I think, than Atwell himself, after looking at his information, is that, like, this is something so diabolical, right, that this guy did to trick everybody. To have these texts be this kind of like this joke. But one could follow the logic and consider possibly that this is something that he didn't expect would go on for so long. If people were more literate and were allowed to read the text in the first place, which they weren't for the longest time when it comes to the gospel, right? I mean, that wasn't until relatively recently that people got to do that. people would have caught on to the correlation between these texts long before, and would have got, I mean, if there's a, if the connection, the way that it's presented, the fact that you can use probability theory the way you can to prove this connection, would have actually have, I mean, he was a Jew who was captured by the Romans and adopted into the Flavian court. And so if it would have gotten out sooner, this would have undermined the whole effort. Because he's somebody who's been asked to write the history of that era, while meanwhile the Romans burn everything else. And anybody that was trying to maintain a semblance of what the original religion of that area actually was had to hide it in the fucking mountains, like in caves and shit, and hang it on ropes on the side, like so that they could so that they could keep it, you know, to whatever, you know, they had to strive in order to maintain that. And so I wonder about that, like, and that was actually one thing that I presented when he was just like, I mean, I think you had actually, Justin, I think you had put up the video of is it Jose Barrera?
Yeah. Did you have a chance to watch?
I did, and I actually showed it to my rabbi, and he enjoyed it, and it was very, very interesting. I really like his work, and Juan actually brought him up too, and I didn't, because of the nature of when he brought it up, I didn't actually get a say. Yes, I watched that, and I really enjoyed it because I like what he brings to the table, but at the same time. I wondered while watching his presentation, the same thing I wondered while looking at what Atwill presents about Josephus is like, didn't, it seems like these people, like, it's hard for me to imagine that these people, when they were doing that, imagine that it would go on for as long as it has without people catching on. Like, or how long is it, like, does it actually take people to catch this kind of shit? Like, when it is as obvious as it is.
There's like a pattern that happens with every new form of media, that the main class of people is kind of one step behind, you know. So that was like when there was writing available, you know, the scribes were kind of the priest class or like a magical class, and there is certainly something to the idea of spelling, as that they were literally just spelling things and casting magic spells, you know. But people didn't know how to read. They knew how to listen, though. So they would go, and they knew how to speak, but they didn't know how to read. And the Bible would have been one of the only books that they actually were around. And then the priest class would be the people who on Sundays or whatever day were reading the Bible or these different texts, you know. And then as people began to, as they began to learn how to read, they didn't learn how to write necessarily, you know. It's really just kind of around this, in this era, that people are really catching on and learning how to write, whereas the new priest class, it's kind of evolved to where there's like lawyers are one form, and I think programmers and coders and engineers and stuff who know this like highly systematized form of language, you know. And I think it's funny, like, people think that the Masons are writing these magic spells and stuff, and that you would have to be an elite Satan worshiper or something to be able to join one of these groups, when the reality is that people would think it's weird for you to join the Masons, but they don't think it's weird for you to go to law school, which is a more elite thing, you know. Like, we have universities in every school, and not everybody can get in, you know. Only a small percentage of people can get in. You have to be highly connected. It's going to cost you $100,000 a year, you know. Like, there's no Masonic, or not that I know of, Masonic lodges that make you pay that kind of dues, you know. And they're like, oh, well, that stuff is secret, you know. Like, you go to law school, that's secret. They're not going to teach that to everybody.
Sure.
So it just becomes people projecting what they don't recognize about what things are onto things that seem kind of ripe for projection. So yeah. The kind of priest class, no matter what, you know.
Right. The printing press, for one, too. I mean, how long have we even been able to print the way that we have been? I mean, that's a relatively recent thing. And the first thing that we go to print when we're able to print is what we consider sacred text. The Zohar was one of the first things to be printed. Like, yeah. That's just, I mean, I mean, something so secret, but at the same time, it's like people wanted to distribute things. If the printing press existed earlier, it probably would have been more widely distributed, and you would have more literate people. That's kind of in the nature of things as well, is just being able to just, I mean, every time you want to write down a text, I mean, it takes a long fucking time to do that longhand, you know?
Yeah.
And then you give them, who do you give it to? But the people who are able to read it. Like, there's that side of it too. I it seems like that both are occurring simultaneously. Also, like, if you look at, like, Kaplan, R.E.A. Kaplan does a really thorough job of explaining the history of Kabbalah being distributed, and how, I mean, a lot of it was just trying to protect the text as part of its secrecy from it not getting destroyed by people who wouldn't appreciate it or understand what it is that they're even looking at. I mean, that's the thing. Like, now we're talking about, we got tomorrow is the shift of the ages or whatever. We'd know a lot more about it if the conquistadors didn't fucking destroy so much of the other artifacts that might give us more clues of things. But people destroy what they don't understand. It's usually the first thing they do in response to it. So,
no, I think, and it might be, I don't know what the plan is for the overall conversation, but it might be interesting to kind of shift to the talk about the 2012 thing.
It's so funny. Just a few minutes ago, I was going to ask everyone if we could kind of not. I was very much enjoying this conversation, but specifically to take advantage of today, I think it's, I don't know, prudent in some way to talk about it at least. And just when I was thinking, well, I'll wait for some sort of break in the conversation. Then you guys went to Terrence McKenna and Time Wave and stuff like that. So I was like, oh, I guess it's already kind of going there.
I want to look up whatever who the names were that were presented last week of the CIA characters that were primary to Jose Arguelles and Terrence McKenna. That he was bringing up. Do you know anything about that, Justin? Because he was pretty certain that the whole 2012 thing came directly out of these two guys that had CIA ties. So I thought
I think there's some legitimacy. So kind of like behind the idea of, I think like evolution's true. I see things evolving, but I think in some ways the way that Darwin formally presented it wasn't totally accurate. And he did have, I mean, there was something in the Descent of Man where he was like ranking the races as far as like what were the more evolved or sophisticated races and what were like the crude races, and that it would be the role of the more evolved races to lead the way and kind of use the other races. So there was definitely like weird stuff, and you can get into, you can't discredit everything he said because it was weird, but I think that isn't usually acknowledged in science class or things like that, that like, oh yeah, well, by the way, like blacks and are not as evolved as white people, and the Irish are the worst of all, you know. You're like, you know, like that would maybe raise a few eyebrows in science class.
Totally. But my favorite book by Darwin is The Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals, which is where he just goes through how we evolve in emotion. And the idea of our like emotional awareness being a sign of evolution, I thought was a really interesting premise.
So the way that idea is kind of misused is, if we're saying things are evolving, you're kind of in some ways hinting at that things are always moving forward and in the proper way that they should be moving.
Right.
And it, when looking at that way, then it's kind of giving divine providence to the U.S. or this Western idea that this must be the most evolved thing.
You know? Right. Well, it's not like Alien, right? Where the alien, and alien is supposed to be like this evolved creature, and that's the justification for the corporation wanting to bring it back to Earth. That they wanted, they were like, we don't care. We got a bigger picture in view about progress, and so there, it's a kind of a satire on the assumptions around evolution. That if really it's about better, stronger, faster, it doesn't matter the humanity. Whereas the reason why I appreciated Darwin's book on emotions is that the implication is that it's actually compassion itself is an indicator of being able to work together. So having empathy, like the ability to truly have empathy and to feel, is necessary in order for survival, which is, you know, which is why I like it so much, because that's so much different from the kind of like Aryan take on Darwinism.
Yeah. And yeah, it's certainly interesting ideas. And I think kind of, so then the point of that stuff that does tie in some ways with the 2012 thing. And I don't think that McKenna was agent, you know, or there's not any proof of that. But I used to, if you would have asked me maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I would have said he was like one of my favorite people. And now I'm actually pretty skeptical of when you start looking at his ideas or where, because he was a brilliant like storyteller, and that's someone who, when you talk about the art of rhetoric, like he was so skilled at conversation and talking and giving speeches that you automatically just kind of want to believe what he's saying, you know, because
yeah, that's the Obama.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like the political, and that's really like the art of rhetoric of that really, you know, and then it really just takes someone to be of good character to not persuade people and manipulate people to do negative things. And it kind of becomes a problem when you become the figurehead instead of having a conversation like this, where there's someone, where we're all sharing ideas, that you then have someone at the front of the room presenting to everyone else. And that person is just a person with opinions too. And they might have ideas about how the world should be run or how things should happen. And then if they have the power of persuading people a particular way, then you got to kind of just be careful about what it is they're saying.
Mm-hmm.